Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Thanks for joining us. An important health topic today. We're talking about antibiotics and why we risk losing their power to kill infections. Most of us have been on antibiotics at one time or another, a sinus infection, a case of strep throat. Antibiotics are the most commonly prescribed drugs in human medicine. But our very familiarity with them is part of the problem, it turns out. The Centers for Disease Control estimate that as much as half of all the antibiotics prescribed aren't needed or are prescribed in the wrong dosage. This is not just a waste, it's dangerous. Every time we use an antibiotic, we give the organisms it's designed to kill another chance to adapt. The same goes for the other major contributor to antibiotic resistance, the animals that we raise for food. Antibiotics are routinely given to livestock in their feed to prevent disease and promote growth. Here, too, the bacteria have lots of chances to evolve into superbugs. In short, we have relied too heavily on these miracle drugs, and they are beginning to lose their mojo. The result, public officials say, is a global health crisis. And here to help us understand the problem and explain what hospitals, governments, and the average citizen can do is Dr. Emily Heil. Dr. Heil is an infectious disease clinical pharmacist at the University of Maryland Medical Center. She also chairs the center's Antibiotic Stewardship Council. Dr. Heil, welcome to Midday.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Richard Bruno is here to give us a sense of what it means for a patient to experience antibiotic resistance. Dr. Bruno is a resident physician in the Combined Family Medicine and Preventive Medicine Program at MedStar Franklin Square and Johns Hopkins University. Dr. Bruno, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much.
So, Dr. Bruno, thousands of people are dying from antibiotic resistance. Why are doctors continuing to overprescribe?
Well, we've seen a number of things that have helped us recognize that this is a problem over the past few decades. In fact, there was a seminal paper, 1989, from two infectious disease doctors at Duke University called Observations on Spiraling Empiricism. And this was sort of a treatise that sort of let us know that there's a lot of inappropriate use of antibiotics. And since then, more and more of the medical and surgical societies have started to take this on as saying, yes, this is a problem. We should be doing something about it. There's a national campaign called Choosing Wisely, and there's 11 medical specialties that have now come out with recommendations saying that maybe we should be more judicious with our use of antibiotics. In fact,
you think? I mean, the CDC says half of all antibiotic prescriptions are either in the wrong dose or they're just inappropriate. And people are beginning to start to say maybe we should be more judicious. It doesn't sound very urgent.
Yes. Well, medicine can be slow to change, but it can adapt new ways as well. So, I think with this very large, set of data in front of us, we can start to sift through it. And that's what the CDC has done by saying, look, there are 2 million infections with antimicrobial resistant bugs. And, 23,000 of them are people who are get so infected that they become septic and end up having organ failure and dying from those. So
well,
that's a big problem.
You work in family medicine. How does it look when a patient is experiencing antibiotic resistance? Can you tell right away as their doctor?
Well, we can tell once we get cultures of wounds or of their blood or of their urine or other parts of their body that may have been infected. But it is tragic. I mean, I'm seeing kids as young as six months old that we have to drain an abscess from. I'm seeing school age kids who are.
I've never encountered that, draining an abscess. An abscess is basically a pile of infection.
A collection of an infectious source somewhere on the body. This particular kid had a skin infection on his back, and it got so infected and red and inflamed. And his parents got worried and they brought him right to the hospital, which was the thing to do. And he ended up having methicillin resistant Staphylococcus aureus, which is the MRSA.
MRSA.
One of the more aggressive bugs.
And how does a kid that young get that?
So there's lots of ways that people can get exposed to these types of bugs. Most likely he got exposed from his parents who harbinger this bacteria on their skin. They have become resistant or somehow picked up a resistant strain of the bug somehow, and then probably passed it on to him inadvertently. And then he maybe got a small wound or nick even on his skin, and the bacteria was able to get in there and set up shop, and he ended up getting an abscess that had to be drained.
So how do you treat that? I mean, in that case, for example.
So that case, we did, the draining itself is a good way to relieve some of that, but you also have to do IV antibiotics at that point. And he required a couple of days within, in inpatient setting in the hospital in order to make sure that we were making a headway and trying to get him healing again.
So it took a few days.
Yeah.
He's okay?
Yeah, he's doing great.
That's great.
Yeah.
Dr. Heil, you are chair of the Antibiotic Stewardship Council at the University of Maryland Medical Center. What is that?
So antibiotic stewardship is really an effort to make sure that all antibiotics used are appropriate. So we provide global oversight to antibiotic use for our whole medical system to make sure that every patient that's getting antibiotics actually has an appropriate indication for them, and that they're also being given at the right dose and for the right length of time, really trying to provide some global oversight to antibiotic use. And these programs are actually popping up at hospitals throughout the country now. The federal government has mandated, hopefully, that by the year 2020, all hospitals will have antibiotic stewardship programs in place to really provide some guidance to our physician colleagues and prescribing colleagues to make sure that we are using antibiotics as appropriately and judiciously as possible.
How did you get interested in this problem?
I've actually always had a big interest in infectious diseases. It started out with HIV specifically, and so I went down that training road and very quickly learned during my training about how widespread antibiotic resistance and inappropriate antibiotic use is, and realized that as a healthcare provider in this field, you can have such an impact not only on individual patients, but on a more global level to really try and curb this crisis.
Well, how do you? I mean, if you're chairing the Antibiotic Stewardship Council, how do you check on what kinds of prescriptions and what kind of use of antibiotics is going on? And how do you know whether it's appropriate?
I've learned a lot about Excel since I started my position about 5 years ago. So we run a lot of electronic reports. We get information. I work on a team with two physicians, and we get information every day about all of the patients in the hospital on antibiotics. And we have a system in which we drill down the ones that are the highest priority for us to review. We look at things such as the patient's medical history, their culture data that we have now available for us from the lab, a lot of different factors to try and to determine if the antibiotics they're currently on are appropriate or necessary. And then we make rounds once a day to go out and talk to the physician teams, discuss the cases with them, provide some education. And, a lot of the things that we run into, as I'm sure Dr. Bruno can highlight, is that we write a lot of guidelines and provide a lot of information about how to use antibiotics, but it's really hard when it's your patient. And so sometimes when we come in and we're that more objective third party that's looking over the shoulder, we're able to help people take a step back and say, I understand that in this situation you felt very strongly initially that this patient may have needed antibiotics, but I think now we have a little bit more information available. The patient's been here for a day or two. Things have stabilized. How about we talk about making some switches and have some impact there?
It sounds like you're very gentle in your suggestions.
We try to be. We try not to be antibiotic police, because no one wants to be the police officers.
Well, do we need antibiotic police?
But I think we sort of do need antibiotic police, and I think you'll find that stewardship programs throughout the country all operate differently. Some have more of an iron fist than others. We feel like our role at the institution I work for is really just to be a resource and to provide education and to help our providers with their patient care. We're not really there so much to judge other people's actions, and we really try to just provide helpful information and suggestions.
That is Dr. Emily Heil here on Midday on WYPR. She is infectious disease clinical pharmacist. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, she's infectious disease clinical pharmacist at the University of Maryland Medical Center. I'm Sheila Cast. Also here with us is Dr. Richard Bruno, a resident physician at, let me get this right here. I don't have it right in front of me. Resident physician at, Combined Family Medicine and Preventive Medicine Program at MedStar Franklin Square and Johns Hopkins University. And you can be part of this conversation. Have you ever had an antibiotic-resistant infection? Tell us about your experience. Join our conversation by calling 410-662-8780 or send us an email to midday@wypr.org. Dr. Heil, I understand you just came back from Rwanda working on this problem. Tell us about that.
Yes, so antibiotic resistance is not isolated just to the United States. This is absolutely a global crisis. And the World Health Organization has put out a global response plan, and they've really challenged that all countries across the world come up with their own individual action plans as to how they are going to target the antibiotic resistance crisis. So the Rwandan Ministry of Health had a symposium that was co-sponsored by the WHO and the University of Maryland to provide some education about antibiotic resistance, reservoirs in the environment, the role of agriculture, how it affects human health, all sorts of topics with physician leaders, veterinary leaders, pharmacy leaders from their country to get their country's action plan really kicked off. So it was an exciting opportunity, and it's nice to see that there is an international response to this crisis since it affects all of us. And not only that, a lot of resistance comes from travel. You can see patterns of people, returning travelers from one country, bringing resistant organisms with them to other countries. And so we all share this problem, and it's nice to see the world coming together about it.
Dr. Bruno, what are some of the ways that antibiotics are improperly prescribed?
Sure. So a lot of times we see, as Dr. Howe was mentioning before, prescriptions for antibiotics for conditions that they would not treat. And sometimes that can be at the initial onset of a viral infection. For example, an upper respiratory infection that's caused by a virus, if you try to treat with an antibiotic, it's not going to do anything to really help that viral infection. Sometimes a patient may...
I remember our GP, I won't tell you how many decades ago this was, but I mean, I was still in high school, and I remember our GP saying, no, I'm not going to prescribe anything for that cold because it's viral, and antibiotic won't do any good. I mean, that's been a long time ago. So that's why I'm so struck by both of you describing the gentle guidance of telling doctors about maybe that wasn't the best thing to prescribe because this is a virus, and that's an antibiotic, and that won't do anything.
Sounds like you had a great doctor.
Yeah, he was, but as I said, it's a long time ago.
Yeah, well, for sure. Well, you know, for example, 16 million visits every year for a sinusitis or a sinus infection in the U.S., and of those 16 million visits that happen, 80% result in an antibiotic being prescribed. And so organizations like the American Academy of Family Physicians put out a Choosing Wisely recommendation saying for the first 7 days, if someone presents and they've only had less than 7 days worth of a sinus infection, don't prescribe an antibiotic. You know, this is something that they're getting out to their members, to the family physicians around the country, and this is something that they try to do public awareness campaigns on as well. So we really have to kind of talk to both, the prescribers and the patients who use them.
We have to take a quick break here. I've got lots more questions I want to ask you, and we've got some other people who already want to be part of this conversation. When we come back, we're going to hear more about the threat to human health from antibiotic resistance. We're here with Dr. Emily Heil, an infectious disease clinical pharmacist at the University of Maryland Medical Center, and Dr. Richard Bruno, a resident physician in the Combined Family Medicine and Preventive Medicine Program at MedStar Franklin Square and Johns Hopkins. Antibiotics so often seem like a quick fix. What would it take to get doctors and patients to stop relying on them so heavily? Tell us what you think. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Today we're talking about a rising threat to global health. We've overused antibiotics, and the bacteria they target are evolving to resist these drugs. And here with me in the studio is infectious disease clinical pharmacist Dr. Emily Heil and resident physician Dr. Richard Bruno of Johns Hopkins and MedStar Health. We were talking about viruses a minute ago and the futility of prescribing antibiotics against a virus. But Dr. Heil, am I right that other kinds of disease-fighting drugs are also becoming inoperative?
Absolutely. So we talk about antibiotic resistance a lot, but really the term should be antimicrobial resistance and antimicrobial stewardship, because we're seeing resistance in viral antiviral medications, antifungal medications, antiparasitic medications. So the threat does not just fall on bacteria alone. Bacteria, of course, cause the vast majority of our infectious issues, so that's why they get the most attention. But this is really more of an antimicrobial crisis that really affects more than just bacteria.
And I guess before we go much further, I should ask one of you to explain how exactly does overuse of antibiotics result in resistance?
So I think really at the simplest level, we all have bacteria in our bodies. They're healthy, they're commensal, they just live there naturally. And some bacteria at baseline are going to harbor some genetic mutations or whatever it may be that may allow them to have some resistance to antibiotics at baseline. When a patient receives antibiotics, what those are going to do are kill off the organisms that are sensitive to that antibiotic, but it may leave a small population of organisms that are resistant. And with continued antibiotic pressure, you can see those resistant organisms able to grow and proliferate when the sensitive organisms are killed. So at the simplest level, it's really they can evolve. The bacteria can evolve to outsmart us and our drugs relatively quickly. And when we continue to give these drugs at either suboptimal doses or when they're not needed, we allow those organisms that are resistant to be the ones to take over.
So this is evolution.
It is evolution, yes. And it's something that we can't stop, but we can certainly slow.
Let's talk to Matt, who is calling us from Union Bridge. Matt, welcome to Midday.
Well, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hey, I heard your topic at the top of the hour, and I had to share. I volunteer for a nonprofit in Frederick that helps people transition out of homelessness or prevent it. And we do temporary assistance with medications. I had a client come in last week with two prescriptions, and one of them was for tetracycline. And I was surprised to see tetracycline because my older brother in the late 50s was on that, and I grew up knowing that tetracycline is what saved his life. And so we call in and get the pricing and before we give the voucher to our client, and the tetracycline was $900. So we sent the client back to the doctor to change it to amoxicillin, which is what the pharmacist suggested, and it was very reasonable. And the client came back and said, nope, they've already tried amoxicillin. They need to go with the tetracycline.
Matt, thank you for sharing that story with us. Dr. Bruno, do you see this? Is this what happens, that we go from a drug that's a few dollars a dose to something that's exponentially more expensive in trying to solve this problem?
Yeah,
these two doctors are nodding their heads at each other.
The drug pricing issue is something that is, it could take a whole nother hour with us, Sheila.
Sure.
It is a huge issue. And, the crux of it is that, some antibiotics are still around and still working and still effective and are covered by insurance companies or the, Medicare, Medicaid that cover it and ensure that, patients can get it for a lower cost. Some are not. I don't know exactly what happened with his client as he described it, but sometimes we do see that certain drugs aren't covered. So a $900, out-of-pocket expense for a patient is going to be, unfortunately, maybe one of the only options if they've tried other things. Now, that being said, there's also a big push to help physicians and pharmacists, pharmacies to understand what is covered, what is covered on a formulary, so that at the point of ordering or the point of prescribing those medications, a physician or a prescriber could see, look, this is not on that patient's formulary. That's going to be a huge out-of-pocket burden for this patient. There are other options. Would you like to choose an alternative?
Well, Dr. Heil,
perhaps I should have thought to ask this already. I mean, if the bacteria are becoming resistant to antibiotics that have been used, why aren't there new antibiotics coming along that the bacteria aren't resistant to?
You have hit the nail on the head as to one of our biggest issues right now is that our antibiotic research and development pipeline is alarmingly dry, and there's a lot of reasons for that. So we have actually haven't had a new antibiotic approved in almost over 20 years with a new target of action. We've had some new antibiotics come to market that sort of expand on the current coverage that we have, but nothing really novel. And this is due to the fact that there's not a lot of motivation from the perspective of the pharmaceutical industry to develop these drugs. So if you think about a blood pressure medicine or something that you would take for your triglycerides, that's something you're going to be on for life. And so from the motivation of the pharma industry, there's a lot of financial incentive to make these types of drugs.
That's going to be a big sale when you stretch it out over
exactly.
years and years and
Whereas
years.
Whereas antibiotics, you may receive them for a week course, maybe a couple of weeks, depending on what your infection is, but it's not something you're going to be on long term. And that's also coupled with the fact that when a new antibiotic comes to market, people like me are going to immediately make sure that they're not being used for all patients because I want to try and conserve them and make sure resistance doesn't develop to them because they are new. So they're not really big money makers. The federal government is aware of this issue and has passed some legislation to try and spur more antibiotic development. There was something called the GAIN Act that was passed about 2 years ago that allows new antibiotics to have an accelerated approval pathway through the FDA, and that has certainly helped encourage more development, but there's still a lot we can do to try and get our pharmaceutical industry back in this game because we are in desperate need of new drugs for our armamentarium.
That is Dr. Emily Heil, an infectious disease clinical pharmacist here on Midday on WYPR. Also, here's Dr. Richard Bruno of Johns Hopkins and MedStar Health, resident physician in the family and preventive practice there. Let's talk to Dory, who is calling us from Annapolis. Dory, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. Over a period of about 4 years, I experienced a whole lot of UTIs and kidney issues and ended up with 5 different surgeries and was on all kinds of different antibiotics to the point where I've developed resistance to a whole mess of them. And my urologist, I guess my point is, bottom line is, as patients, we tend to get so nervous that we put pressure on the doctors to order something. But my urologist put his foot down and said, absolutely not, you will not take anything unless you have fever over 101.5, and primaries really balk at this because they, you know, they want to give you something to make you feel better. But I found that, you know, hey, you can, you know, with the primary keeping an eye on you or someone keeping, you know, medical person keeping an eye on you, you can live through these infections. And there's so many few medicines that are antibiotics are left to try. They've had to put their foot down in order that I would have some selection when I do have a real crisis.
Okay, Dory, I really appreciate the call because what Dory has focused me on was, when we were talking about evolution, I'm thinking of how the antibiotics change this whole class of or other of organisms that are in different people in the environment. They're in the hospital, they're all around. But Dory focuses us on her own resistance. She describes it as her own resistance to bacteria. Can you sort this out for me, Dr. Bruno?
Yes, thank you. And Dory, thank you for calling. And I think she also speaks to having a really important, crucial part of this is having a good relationship with your provider, someone who knows your history, knows your background, knows what's worked in the past, and has a good plan going forward. And I think that, you know, it is unfortunate that oftentimes people go through these cycles of more and more antibiotics to treat, and becomes a sort of a downward spiral sometimes, and you are left with very old antibiotics that maybe have a lot of side effects, and this is gets to the point that Dr. Heil was speaking to earlier. But I think I really picked up on that, and I really appreciated her mentioning that relationship, because I think that's really crucial to have someone who you can be open and frank with and have a really caring relationship there that can give you the right plan of care and the right plan of action.
But the implication of Dory's question to me is that some people are more at risk of not being able to use antibiotics than most of us, that there are some people especially sensitive to this. And that confuses me because Dr. Heil had explained how evolution makes a whole bunch of bugs resistant to antibacterial. So I'm confused about why it hits some patients more than others.
So some patients are going to have increased exposure to antibiotics for various reasons. So like in Dory's case, you know, she had recurrent urinary tract infections for which she required multiple courses of antibiotics that then drove the resistance for her. A lot of the other patients that are at a higher risk for these infections compared to the general public are patients that have immunocompromising conditions. Their immune system is just not up to snuff compared to other patients. This could be from cancer and chemotherapy that they're receiving. It could be patients that have received an organ transplant, patients with HIV. There's a lot of reasons you might not have a fully functional immune system, and those are the patients that are probably going to be at higher risk, one, because their immune system doesn't function as well, but two, those are patients that likely are going to receive more courses of antibiotics throughout their lifetime than the average patient.
I want to raise another aspect of all this before we go much further, and that is we've been talking about humans, but antibiotic overuse is also linked to farmers. The Maryland legislature looked at a bill that would have banned the use of antibiotics for disease prevention in feed for farm animals. The bill stalled in the Maryland House. Tell us about that issue and how it's being addressed. Dr. Bruno?
Sure. So this bill in particular was sort of taking a cue from some FDA guidance that has been issued over the past few years, recognizing the issue of animal use, the use of antibiotics in animal feeds, I should say.
The
Food and Drug Administration.
Food and Drug Administration,
right.
Federal.
And they have offered guidance and forthcoming rules that will help ideally tackle this issue on the national scale. There's a few different uses in antibiotics, and we've seen over the past 50, 60 years, the use of antibiotics in animal feed for growth promotion has obviously made animals larger, but at the cost of potentially fueling a lot of the antibiotic and antimicrobial resistance that's going on in the animals themselves.
And Dr. Howell, is this because we eat these animals? Is that how they affect our own?
Not quite. But the reason that what's happening in agriculture is so concerning is because the antibiotics used for either growth promotion or disease prevention are used at subtherapeutic doses. So they're getting low doses, low exposure of antibiotics, and that is a perfect setup to allow resistance to develop because you're not giving enough drug to fully kill off the organism, but you're giving enough drug for the bacteria to then outsmart that drug. And so that's why it's particularly concerning. There hasn't been a direct link from eating meat from an animal that's received antibiotics and transmission to humans, but we find that transmission happens through other environmental reservoirs. Whenever a human takes an antibiotic, then that antibiotic passes through our stool. It can get into the sewage system, into wastewater that might be used to then water an agricultural farm. Same for animal waste. These antibiotics can perpetuate at low doses sort of in our environment, and that's where the link has been found. We've also found a direct link between farmers caring for these animals being exposed and also harboring more resistant bacteria than people that do not have interaction with these farm animals. So there is a direct link to humans, but it hasn't been found from actually consuming the animal.
Frank is calling us from Aberdeen with a concern about this. Frank, welcome to Midday.
Yes, it goes beyond what you're saying. My understanding is 80 to 90% of the antibiotics sold by the pharmaceutical industry is to agriculture. And I really do believe that it is contributing to harm to our society, and we should prohibit the use of antibiotics to fatten cattle. Now, to use it to go over and treat cattle, that's something else. And cattle and chickens and everything else. To treat an illness is one thing. To fatten them up is another. And you should have a label on everything, whether that animal animal had been given antibiotics. That's all I wanted to say.
Frank, I appreciate your calling. One of the points I think that the Maryland Farm Bureau made in testifying against the legislation that has now stalled in the Maryland legislature is that in terms of these low doses of prophylactic use of antibiotics for disease control in a herd is that pigs can't tell you when they're sick. And so by the time a farmer may actually see the signs that virus or whatever it is that is, well, it better be not a virus if they're using antibiotics, but say that infection may have taken hold and they can't really control it. The witness from the Maryland Farm Bureau said this bill would be a death sentence for pigs. Do either of you want to respond to that? I know animal husbandry is not your expertise. So
yeah, I would definitely say animal husbandry is not my expertise, but I have learned a lot through this process and was very much in favor of the Maryland bill. I think the FDA guidance is really going to help try and get rid of some of that use for growth promotion, but it left an important loophole in that you could still use antibiotics at subtherapeutic doses for sort of broad prevention of disease. And like you said, you know, a sick animal is a different story. If you have a sick animal and you want to prevent other animals that were in close contact with that animal from getting sick, that would be an appropriate time to then use antibiotics. But this sort of global throwing antibiotics at all animals is what really gets us into trouble. And, you know, really focusing on better animal husbandry practices is probably one of the more important things we can do to prevent the animals from getting sick in the first place. And there are other countries in the world where this use of antibiotic in agriculture have been banned with some degree of success. And so I think it's time for us to take cues from those areas.
We need to take another short break here. Lots more to talk about with Dr. Richard Bruno, resident physician at Johns Hopkins and MedStar Health, and Dr. Emily Heil, infectious disease clinical pharmacist. And your calls. Do you think livestock owners should be banned from using antibiotics to prevent disease? What if it means a rise in mortality on the farm? Join our conversation. Send an email to midday@wypr.org or call us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. If you're just joining us, we're talking about a problem with the potential to affect us all. The miracle drugs of the 20th century, antibiotics, are losing their power to cure as microorganisms evolve to resist them. I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Bruno, resident physician at MedStar Health and also at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. And with me in the studio also is University of Maryland Medical Center infectious disease clinical pharmacist, Dr. Emily Heil. Do we need legislation to control the overuse of antibiotics, or do you think agriculture and medicine will self-regulate? Give us a call at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. Charlotte is calling us from Joppa. Charlotte, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi, thank you. I really do enjoy the discussion today. The problem with the overuse of antibiotics has vexed me since I immigrated from Europe almost 40 years ago because it was overprescribed then over here. My question is, patients that do not follow the entire course of action as far as taking the medication and then flush the remainder down the sewer system, I know it's probably just a small amount, but how does your panel think that affects the rest of the population? And I take my answer off air.
Thank you, Charlotte. Thank you, Charlotte. Dr. Bruno?
Well, it is a great question. You know, our sewage systems are not typically set up to filter out a lot of molecules that may enter it before the water returns to waterways. And we can find residues in our water. I think that there's been a big push recently to have responsible disposal of medications, and a lot of every clinic that I've been at MedStar Health and the hospital there and through Johns Hopkins as well has responsible disposal containers so the patients can bring their old prescriptions, bring them in, dispose of them in a way that will be treated responsibly.
How does that happen? I've always wondered about that. When you bring your drugs in, if you don't flush them, is somebody? I mean, how do you destroy something? Do you incinerate them?
Yes, we usually, a lot of places do have safe drug take-back programs, and there are places that are responsible for safe handling of these medications, and usually it involves incineration.
We got an email from Kim. I'm not sure where Kim is, but she asked, do the guests know if Minute Clinics and similar services tend to overprescribe antibiotics? Our family pediatrician says they do and does not recommend using them. Dr. Bruno?
Well, I think it gets back to that relationship thing that we talked about earlier, Sheila. You know, a Minute Clinic or, you know, an urgent care center oftentimes will not have your entire medical history in front of them. They're sort of seeing a sick patient right in front of them, and they have to make a decision in the moment. You know, does this patient, in my clinical opinion and based on the lab work or the imaging that I may get, require antibiotics? And a lot of times antibiotics are given out empirically for the purposes of trying to treat a presumed infection. I think what is, you know, would be a better scenario is if a patient has a long-term relationship with their family physician, with their pediatrician, with their internist, someone, a primary care doctor who's taking care of them day to day and understands the history.
And I think one thing that you have to think about when you're coming to those clinics is what the patient's expectations are. So as a patient, if you're sick and you're going to see a doctor or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, your expectation is that they're going to do something for you. And with a lot of things like viral infections, there's really nothing that can be done from a medication standpoint. You can take some Tylenol or ibuprofen, you can rest, you can increase your fluid intake, but no antibiotic is going to cure that. But I think a lot of the times the patients can also put pressure on their provider to give them a prescription for something so that they feel like they are receiving some degree of treatment. And it can be hard in these conditions where really supportive care, as we call it, is the main answer. So I think it's, as Dr. Bruno alluded to, these providers may not have that relationship with the patient and know the full history, but there may also be some degree of patient-induced pressure on that provider to do something for them. If that it turns into an antibiotic prescription, you know, so be it.
We had a caller who couldn't stay with us who was asking, as I understood it, what result on resistance it would have if you took antibiotics but didn't rest, didn't do the other things that would give your body a chance to shake off this infection. Would that then somehow contribute more to making the bacteria antibiotic resistant?
It's hard to say. I know, you know, we know that stress and sleep are a big factors in the healing process, and so, you know, antibiotics give your body an extra helping hand in its immune system already fighting an infection, right? So I think that if you're immunocompromised, if you have a condition where your immune system doesn't work quite right, or if you're under a lot of stress, not able to sleep a lot, your body already has a hit against it. So, you know, that could be, you know, potential breeding ground for more, you know, aggressive bacteria to help to fight against your immune system. So I think that there, it's hard to say exactly how it would break down, but obviously we always recommend, you know, sleep and rest as part of the healing process as well.
But I guess, is there any simple way to describe, you just use the phrase breeding ground, and when we talk, as we've been talking about drugs being prescribed for human patients, their bodies basically are the breeding ground where this evolutionary change may take place, correct? So in that sense, does the patient, by providing the breeding ground, is there a way to make it more or less likely that bacteria in that breeding ground will be killed versus will make themselves stronger and resistant?
I think that comes down to, one, you know, finishing your course of antibiotics. If you are prescribed antibiotics, you must finish the entire treatment course, even if you start to feel better after a couple of days, because not completing your treatment course is going to allow that breeding ground to be a suboptimal environment if you do not finish the entire course of antibiotics and don't kill off all of those bad bugs that are present. But beyond that, there's not a lot you can really do to try and change your own environment.
Okay, but okay. Answer taken. In general, though, what can individuals do? I mean, we've just said this is a big global crisis, a huge problem. Finish your course of antibiotics that has been prescribed, point number one, that you've each referred to a few times. What else can an individual really do?
I was just going to say lots of disease prevention, you know, prevent infections from the first place. Hand washing is
exactly.
One.
Yes. And coughing in your sleeve, sneezing into your sleeve, you know.
Not to spread diseases.
Exactly. You know, doing some spring cleaning, you know, making sure your house is, you know, clean. There's a lot of surfaces in our environment that can harbor bacteria and viruses. So doorknobs, countertops, those kinds of things are typically what we call fomites, or, you know, harbingers of these types of infectious, you know, pathogens. So keeping your surface areas clean.
Anything else while we're talking about what individuals can do if they're motivated and upon hearing you guys talk about what a big problem this is?
Right. And then we talked a lot about the food industry. And so I think we can, as consumers, put pressure by our purchasing power on the industry to help, you know, advance the type of practices that will lead to less resistance. And that can mean, you know, if you do buy meat, purchasing meat that's been raised without antibiotics.
Jan is calling us from Baltimore with an interesting question. Jan, welcome to Midday.
Hello, everyone. Just really quick, I recently had a slew of unused prescribed medications I was taken off of, and I had thought that I could call any pharmacy and they would take them, and I was told no. Then I called hospital or two, and they said, no, we don't take them. And then I called 311, and they said, oh, call the Northern District Police Station. I said, really? And I called them, and the desk clerk said, oh, yeah, we have this metal box, looks like a mailbox in the lobby, and you can just come and put them in there 24/7 because we're the police station. And I did, and I don't know where they go from there. I asked them, and they said they didn't know. So that's all. I just thought
Jan,
thank you. Everybody should know.
Thank you. Thank you for the call. I turned to the pharmacist at the table, Dr. Heil. Is the police station the first place to go? Do pharmacies not accept unused drugs?
Not all pharmacies do accept unused drugs. There are some that do. There is a take-back day that's sponsored by the University of Maryland School of Pharmacy that happens once a year where you can bring any and all unused medications to the School of Pharmacy down in Baltimore City, and we'd be happy to take care of those and make sure they get disposed of properly. But the police station is also an appropriate place, especially if any of those medications are potentially controlled substances. And like I said, they're all going to go to a central facility where they are incinerated and disposed of properly.
We have an email from Rachel in Baltimore, who says, please ask your guests about the impact of the reduction of labs in medical offices. When I was a kid, swabs were taken and bugs identified before a course of action was determined. Now it seems like labs are usually outside the doctor's office and sometimes in an entirely different business. What effect does this disconnection have on how antibiotics and other medications that fight microbials are being prescribed?
Yes, practices, you know, vary wildly. It's hard to say, you know, what the effect has been. I do know that, you know, we have, through technology, been able to identify these things more at the point of care. So we do have rapid tests that can be done, you know, in the clinic exam rooms. We can test.
That seems really important if a doctor is not going to prescribe the wrong kind of drug for a particular ailment.
It's true. It helps a lot, I think, especially for things like strep throat, where you can do a quick swab of somebody's throat and you can see, you know, in a couple of minutes whether or not this person indeed has a bacterial infection or not, and you can treat them appropriately. So I think that while maybe there has been a trend toward less actual lab work being done in a clinic, that some of these point of care tests have actually been pretty cost saving as well.
Liz has a question about technology, or a point about technology. I think Liz, welcome to Midday.
Hey, how are you?
Fine.
I just had a really quick question about what the doctors know of or heard of, or if they know of any clinical trials going on right now regarding bacteriophage in terms of treating a bacterial infection with something maybe a little bit more natural, and what their thoughts on that are.
Thanks for the call, Liz. I've always pronounced it phage, but she's talking about the use of one organism to fight one you're trying to get rid of. Is that something either of you see on the horizon?
Yeah, potentially. I mean, there's a lot of buzz about pre and probiotics and what role the microbiome has. For example, there's an infection called C. difficile, which is when a bacteria that can lie dormant in your gut can sort of rear its ugly head and cause very severe diarrhea when you're exposed to antibiotics that kill off the other healthy bacteria in your GI system. And so looking at actually replacing your GI system with those healthy bacteria may be the best way to combat that C. difficile infection. So I think there are a lot of disease states where potentially using one organism to fight another is going to be where the future is.
Jeff emailed us, piggybacking on our conversation about why there aren't powerful antibiotics on the horizon, new antibiotics. Also, any chance, Jeff writes, any chance that an alternative to new antibiotics, such as introducing benign bacteria to outcompete their harmful ones? Is that the kind of thing you were just referring to?
Yeah, exactly. That's the sort of thing. And then, you know, we're also looking into vaccinations as a way of prevention. So In the absence of new antibiotics, there's definitely other ways we can go about things. And then, as Dr. Bruno was mentioning, one of our biggest areas is just more rapid diagnosis. If we can find out what's going on with a patient sooner, then we can target our therapy sooner and hopefully avoid some of this unnecessary antibiotic use. So I think we're really trying to look at the problem from all angles.
We're down to just like a minute and a half. I'd like to hear from each of you where you think, what do you foresee if we continue on the road we're on? Dr. Bruno?
Well, unfortunately, I think you're going to see particular areas that have more and more resistance patterns, and that would mean that more people will be exposed to more aggressive types of bacteria. These bacteria will not be able to be treated with oral antibiotics and would potentially require hospitalization, IV antibiotics, and can result in more and more morbidity and mortality, unfortunately. So it's impingent on all of us, I think, to not only try and be prudent with our the drugs that we prescribe as prescribers, but also as patients, and trying to not ask for antibiotics as a first treatment for a presumed infection. Let the provider that you see do his or her tests and do his or her exam, and then come up with a plan together.
Dr. Howell, what do you foresee if we stay on this road?
I mean, not to be very doom and gloom, but I think we are sort of catapulting ourselves into a post-antibiotic era at the rate we're going. We've only had antibiotics available to us since, you know, the early 1940s, and as soon as they come out, we've seen resistance develop to them, and it's just getting worse at sort of an exponential rate. And so I think it's something that we should be really afraid of. It is a public health crisis. It's a global health crisis, and you know, it needs effort from patients to be more responsible, the public to be more responsible, providers to be more responsible, farmers to be more responsible. There's a lot that everyone can do to try and slow this down.
And I'm really grateful to you both for telling us about it, for giving us some insights here. University of Maryland Medical Center Infectious Disease Clinical Pharmacist Dr. Emily Heil and resident physician Dr. Richard Bruno from MedStar Health and the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. I also want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Hope you have a great spring weekend and special wishes for everyone celebrating Easter on Sunday. I'm Sheila Cast. Up next, Here and Now.